Have EVs hit a tipping point? The top 10 things we hate about cars, and Jeremy Clarkson goes from being on the Beeb to being a boob.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 280 for March 27th of 2015. Second Gen Volt, first rate car. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary, here we are again.
Here we are. I was down in Orlando this week at the National Plastics Exposition, and I got to tell you, metals are on their way out.
Whoa.
Dying. Up or out?
Out.
Oh, dear.
Unbelievable. Some of the things that...
So it's not going to be all aluminum,
Oh, my. I mean, I saw this part that went from being an aluminum die casting to being an injection molded part under the hood.
Whoa.
Combination intake manifold and charge air cooler. So they're actually taking heat with this thing. I mean, it's just amazing what these guys are doing across the board.
And when you think of the advances coming in 3D printing, that's going to be largely polymers too, I would think.
Yeah.
I saw a 3D pen this week where you can draw.
I saw that.
Is that cool?
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that voice, for those not watching the video version, is Frank Marcus from Motor Trend here in the studio with us. Good having you back here, Frank.
Always a pleasure.
And then we got to introduce our special guest for today, Andrew Farah, the chief engineer on the new Chevrolet Volt. And Andrew, awesome having you here.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here. I love talking about the Volt, and I hear that's what we're going to do.
Well, yeah, you bet we are. So who's going first?
So Generation 2, how significant are there changes from Generation 1?
Almost everything in some regards, when you think about it. You know, we are coming off of what we call the Delta architecture, or the second generation of that, or D2, sometimes we talk about it. But when you think about it, our body structure and our powertrain, two of the key parts of that, are all different. We share some other components with it, but most of them are some of the simpler bolt-on components, if you will. But from a propulsion system, Gen 1, all new, right, comparison-wise. Body structure-wise, all new developed. We're using aluminum in places where we didn't use it before. We've got an all-new engine, an all-new drive unit, an all-new battery. There's really so much to talk about. And then we've got great all-new styling inside and out. There's just so much that's new. It's really hard to know where to start.
Your team must either be the smartest guys in GM's history or a right place at the right time, because the numbers in terms of percentage of mass reduction and performance improvement and all that kind of thing are really kind of stunning. I mean, what is it, almost 250 pounds out of the whole car? I mean, that just never happens from one gen to another these days. A lot of low-hanging fruit, though, from a Gen 1 moonshot car like this.
Well, so what we did, I mean, relative to mass, we did a really good job of taking things that, when we did the first car, really had to be separate and bringing them together, both physically and functionally. That's really how most of the mass reduction was achieved. Yes, we continued to work on, typical lightweight materials and things like that, but we're really getting a lot of the mass reduction through work that we've done on the propulsion components, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. As we went through, you talked about the performance increases and things like that. Sort of our motto as we went forward from Gen 1 to Gen 2 was Gen 1 or better everywhere, right? That's how we knew if we were succeeding or not. And we think we've done a pretty good job of pulling that off.
Andrew, why don't you and I get up and walk a little bit around the car? Frank and Gary can continue to ask some questions, but let's show the audience a little bit of what we're talking about here. And show us under the hood. You've got this new powertrain there. Why don't you explain what all is different about it?
Well, the good thing, right, we're one of the first benefactors, we get the first to benefit from the new 1.5-liter small gas engine, but this is a special version for us that has some particular things on the inside that are good. We've got a 12.5-to-1 compression ratio. We've got exhaust gas recirculation. We've got a really high authority on the timing that we can control, you know, independently. And that way we can do all of this for unleaded regular gasoline.
No more premium.
No more premium gasoline. And
but you went up in displacement. Was it the other one, a 1.4?
There was a 1.4, and there was a lot of controversy, or not controversy, but questioning. You're going to go bigger, you're going to go smaller, you're going to go turbocharged, you're going to go three-cylinder. And in the end, what you see is we actually went larger, and you go larger because that way you can get the same amount of power at a lower RPM. And so after you do deplete the battery and you are running on gasoline, we can still get a quiet, smooth performance. And that's very important for our customers today. Say that they like the fact that once you have depleted the battery, you can still be quiet and have a lot of that EV feel retained. And so we do that.
And is the fuel efficiency improved as well?
Fuel efficiency much improved. 41 miles per gallon now combined average.
So just pretty good. Running on pure
just
gasoline.
Running on pure gasoline. Then, of course, don't forget about the 50 miles of EV range. That's a significant improvement. So when you bring all that together, the fuel economy and the EV range, we think that most people are going to go over 1,000 miles on average between gasoline fill-ups, and that's great.
Let's move down here and talk a little bit about that, because you've got this great cutaway that you brought to the studio, and part of the cutaway includes this battery.
Right. The battery still runs down the middle and then across underneath the back seat, sort of in the shape of a T. The battery has gone through a significant reduction in the number of cells. There are one-third fewer cells. Each cell is bigger, and there's more energy overall in the pack. Now we're up to 18.4 kilowatt hours of energy.
And what was it before?
16 and change.
Okay, 16. Right. So you've gone from 16 and change to 18 and
change.
That's
right.
But it's the same physical size?
Same physical size, roughly within a liter. But it's lighter. It's about 20 pounds lighter. Hmm. So, again, energy by volume up about 20%. Overall volume in the car about the same. Total energy up. So that's one of the things that contributes strongly to being able to get 50 miles now.
And in the trunk, there's more of a cutaway here. Yeah, obviously, you guys wanted to highlight this. What are the highlights that we're looking at in here?
Well, one thing is we're still a hatchback, which is great because very utilitarian in the sense of what you can do with it when you're not just driving. You can still put great big things in the back. Seats fold down. What you're seeing here in the cutaway is where the onboard charger is that converts AC from the wall to DC. And also you see our auxiliary power module, which makes the 12-volt power for the car. Our low voltage system is still 12 volts.
Yeah, cool. Good stuff.
Yep.
Just wanted to show the audience more physically of what we've got here in the studio.
Right. Can we see the fifth seat?
The fifth seat. Okay. So, you know, what's interesting is a lot of questions, controversy, if you will, about the fifth seat. But when we first showed the car in California before we even had the Detroit Auto Show, you know, we had a group of owners come out. And we talked a little bit, and people said, are you going to say anything about the fifth seat? I said, no. I'm going to bring the people in and let them look at the car and see what kind of reaction we get. And this was a group of owners, right? And we brought them in, let them walk around the car. And as they're looking, one of them turns to me and says, there's a fifth seat back there. And I said, yes, there is. And, you know, then everybody's, you know, got head in the car looking around. And they go, you know, that's really good. For the time when I need that fifth seat for the short ride, to bring that third kid home, you know, from the football game, those kinds of things, that's just exactly what I need. And we kind of left it at that. You know, we're not saying you're going to ride cross country in that seat, but it's going to be there for the times when you need it. And that's really what we're trying to achieve there.
And so really, when you say fifth seat, you've got more of a bench seat that would accommodate three people in the back, not just the two people like the first generation.
Exactly. And we still have a nice, when you are just riding two. The other thing is we didn't want to compromise when you just have two people back there. We've still got a great armrest, great cup holders, accessory jacks, those kinds of things. So we still tried to make sure we didn't lose anything that we had when we had that 2+2 seating in Gen 1.
Well, the tech nerd in me is most intrigued by the powertrain, which now, of course, as we know, has two more closely sized motors and two full planetary gear sets instead of the one,
right.
Which gives us two EV modes and three gas, you know, modes, as opposed to whatever that was like four before. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that, especially the three gasoline modes, because I'm intrigued that the time when the engine is actually turning the wheels is very small, like 12% of the city cycle and similar on the highway. Very, very low percentage of that.
Right. Well, clearly, you know, first, what's the motivation, right? Why did we change it at all? We wanted to make a system that was overall more efficient, first electrically, and we did that by being able to use two motors most of the time, whereas before we were using one motor most of the time. That was step one. And second, after you get to the point where you've depleted the battery, the consumers, you know, our Gen 1 owners have been telling us, hey, once you're there, as long as you're still quiet and smooth, it's about fuel economy, right? Do whatever you have to do to get us the best fuel economy. And so that's where these three modes, if you will, were born of being able to, you know, how can you do that? And of course, one of the things we do, as you stated, is we take whenever we can, because it's most efficient to take some of that torque right to the road, but you still have to do that in a very smooth and quiet way. You don't want the engine revving. You don't want it really following your foot any more than it has to. You want to make use of the battery to deal with all of those ups and downs, right? And you want to run the engine as smoothly and as consistently as you possibly can. And that's what we're doing.
Now, another thing we learned fairly recently is that the new Malibu hybrid is going to use essentially that transmission and that general system.
Right.
Was that at all a driving factor? Because obviously the duty cycle is quite different. That's always going to be living in those three modes. Mm-hmm. Did that car drive any of the decision-making on the Volt?
Well, as I said before, what's the motivation, right? Fuel economy. And when you're doing a hybrid like the Malibu, that's what it's all about, right? There's no plug-in opportunity. You can't take any energy from the wall. It fits in the sense of what it does, right? So when you're thinking about it, what have I got? What's available? What can we do there? It's a perfect fit for the Malibu hybrid.
But three modes had to be better than two if you're not going to ever have someone driving most of their miles on electric.
Yeah. Well, you need, I mean, the engine's going to be running.
Yeah, basically. It's not totally an accident that we never saw the Gen 1 Volt drivetrain powering a regular hybrid.
No, it wasn't set up to do that. Right. It really wasn't designed for that.
So this car has the regen on demand, the paddles. Now, is that the same system that's used in the ELR, or is
it
different?
We actually pioneered it with the ELR, and it's something that you either, you know, I hate to say it, it's something you either love it or you hate it.
I love it. I think it's cool.
Well, explain
how it works.
Okay, first, you know, the Volt, as well did the ELR, has a fully blended regenerative braking system. So when you push the brake pedal, you're getting most of what's happening by regen, right? Friction only comes in at the end of the stop, and if you need it for stability, it also comes in if you're, you know, in a wet situation, those kinds of things. But what we found in Gen 1 was a number of people were driving by shifting to low, right? And it's a little clunky to do that, and you have to take your hand off the wheel and those kinds of things. So when we were working on the ELR, we came up with this idea, well, what if we moved that capability up to the steering wheel? We did ELR, and they liked it. They thought it was good. And for the people who wanted to play a little more, try to be hypermiling just a little more, those kinds of things. And so we said, well, let's bring that into the Volt as well, and we did. Took us a while to decide exactly. We played around with some different locations on where we might want to put the control, but in the end we said the steering wheel is the right place for it, and we moved some other things around to make room. So
if you're riding the brake, are you actually getting more energy?
If you're riding the brake while you're driving down the road, I have a letter for you. It's called my perpetual motion letter. Okay. I get a lot of different mail sometimes from different people about these ideas, but no, it doesn't work.
When Dan Akerson was the CEO of the company, he said they got to take $10,000 a cost out of that Volt to really, you know, make it meaningful for the company. How much progress have you guys made?
Well, John, we've made a lot of progress. I can't tell you exactly how much and in what areas, but as you can guess, as we were putting together our plan for the Gen 2 Volt, we spent a lot of time understanding how far we could take certain things like EV range and balance those with the idea of how much would people pay and how much is it going to cost us. And we've come up with, I think, a really good balance here, and we'll announce pricing probably in another 4 to 6 weeks. So then some of that will be out.
Tesla has three different battery packs, mm-hmm. three different price points. Did you think about anything like that with this car?
Early on, we talked about it, right? We said maybe this would be a good idea, and then we looked at where we are today and trying to always make sure that we could handle the bulk of people's commutes. 80%, you know, is where we were for Gen 1. Going to 50 miles, we think we're going to, you know, we'll be closer to 90. Of course, it's really hard to get that last tail for the people who have those long commutes. So we said that's still our mission. That's still what we want to be, Gen 1 or better, right? And so we have one battery.
And the 50-mile EV range that you're talking about, is that an EPA number?
Yeah, that's an EPA number, so that's not to be laughed at in some regards, right? It'll be, even in the summertime on my Gen 1, I don't have too much trouble beating the EPA numbers at all, just with average driving, you know. And as you know, in the wintertime, with an electric car, you know, you're going to use some energy for heating and those kinds of things. But with Gen 2, we've done a couple things to even help with that, right? Now we have a heated steering wheel that you can get that's available. That takes the chill off if you don't want to use up all your energy, you know, heating the cabin. We also have optional heated rear seats, too. And that has made my children very happy.
Speaking of that, I took delivery of the Motor Trend's Car of the Year Volt in January of whatever that 2012 or 13, whenever it was.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt like that car never really got warm and cozy on the inside. Have you done anything to improve the cabin heating?
Mm-hmm. Right, we've got
on top of the, you know, warm steering wheel and seats and so forth.
Yeah. We've got an electric heater, and it is larger this time around, right? And a little bit more efficient, but it's still larger, so it's going to burn more energy if you want to, right? We still offer the eco heating mode and the max heating mode that you can select. We've made a lot of the controls easier to get to and easier to understand too, a little more conventional relative to heating, ventilation, air conditioning. That was also some of the feedback we got from Gen 1, which was, you know, you guys could make it a little easier for us to get to the things we want to get to, and we did that.
Did you think of a heat pump?
You know, we've kicked around the idea of a heat pump on different occasions. I was a part of the EV1 program. We had a heat pump in the EV1 program. We looked at it again briefly, but we think there's still some developmental work that needs to be done there, and we wanted to go with something that we were sure was going to give us better performance and be there when we needed it to be.
You mentioned in response to Frank's earlier question about taking weight out, about how you put things closer together, right, and as a consequence, you reduced weight.
Sure.
Could you explain that?
Right. You know, there's different kinds of integration, if you will, right? There's functional integration where you take things that you can, will perform similar functions, and you make one thing do the job of two. But then there's physical integration too, where you take two things and you just put them in together in the same package, eliminate walls, save space, fasteners, assembly, those kinds of things. And a great example of that would be the drive unit. In Gen 1, we had separate power electronics that sat in a different place, and we had to have large cables that came down to connect get the three phase down to the motors, and there were two motors, so six large cables. For Gen 2, all of that is integrated into one package, so we basically bring DC right to the drive unit and then control signals. And then built into it are the power electronics and some of the low-voltage electronics. And so you don't need so many cases, walls, space between them, fasteners, all the different things. And that's one of the keys to weight and size reduction that we've got over the system. And, of course, the other for the drive unit is the fact that in Gen 1, right, we had one large motor and a smaller motor. And the large motor did most of the work most of the time. Now we've got two medium-sized motors, closer to the size of I called it small, from Gen 1. But we use both of them most of the time. And so that, I guess, is what I was talking about.
Any thought to a high-performance version? I mean, performance is all the rage these days, and people really pay for it. Why not a Volt SS?
Well, this is high performance. 0 to 30 in 2.6 seconds, a lot faster than it used to be. And our 0 to 60 times down to 8.4, some improvement there, too. The idea of cowling differently, right, using more energy, things like that. I've thought about it. You know, SEMA comes but once a year, and those kinds of opportunities are out there. But right now, we're ready to get this one into the marketplace, and we think people are going to notice the performance difference. I know I do. I think it's kind of funny. You know, when we were first laying it out on paper and doing those kinds of things, I was like, a little bit more. That's not going to be that much. People aren't going to really pick up on it, right? It's amazing how you pick up on it, particularly that 0 to 30 improvement.
Yeah, I got to believe it. And, you know, 8.4 seconds, you said, or 8.6?
8.6, 2.4.
Yeah. Will it be any difference when the engine is on or off?
Backwards, sorry.
Okay. Hey, look, hold that thought. We'll come right back to it, but we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Frank, you were asking something.
In Motor Trend, we noticed that when you tested in full EV mode, it was a little bit slower, especially the quarter mile and the higher speeds, than it was when the engine was on. That was back when there was only, you know, the two modes of engine on driving. Would that still be the case, or is that...
Well, you know, I think of the Volt as an electric car first, so all the numbers we quote are always in electric mode, right? Is it a little bit faster when the engine's running? Yes. But, you know, significantly different? No. And similar, again, to the difference you saw in Gen 1.
So basically, when you're saying that you wanted to improve in performance across the board, it was
right.
Performance in terms of the 0 to 60 time and performance in terms of the efficiency
Everything.
That you're achieving.
We wanted to improve the performance of the rear seat seating. You know, there's another inch of space back there. You know, it's
Gen 1 or better, baby.
Right, Gen 1 or better. You know, just everything. Because the great thing about being able to do the second version, you know, not all the chiefs get the opportunity to go, you know, and take the second one. The first one is always, you know, the first Volt. There were a lot of new things. We had a lot of stuff we had to do, and we were doing it at a difficult time. Second time around, you get a chance to work with a lot of the same people. You bring them back in and say, okay, we've got a clean slate again here. What are we going to do to make it better? What did we do? We sat down with everybody, examined what we did good, what we did bad, and said, let's do it this time, and let's get it all right. So,
hey, we've got a whole bunch of questions here. MacDaddy121 is asking a question that I heard a lot when the car was first shown. Why does it look like a Honda Civic?
Well, as we know, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder in some ways. You know, we did a lot of work on the front end to make sure that we've got good aerodynamics and still a great look. As you might notice here, the bright grille work is becoming a signature element for Chevrolet Electrics. I think it's something that will continue. We've got a great new headlight arrangement up there with LED beams, and we've got a new DRL that's very distinctive when it's going down the road. We also have the aero shutters that you can't see that help us with aerodynamics. So we're doing a lot of things to try to bring aerodynamics to the front end. And as you know, that can bring some commonality looking to things.
Whether it looks like a Civic or not, it's definitely more of a mainstream style.
Absolutely. More contemporary. And so why, right? And this is another thing that people ask me about. They say, I really like the way the Gen 1 looked. You know, the Gen 2 looks a little bit. What are we trying to do now with the industry, right? We are trying to get more people to move toward it, right? And sometimes you still do that by looking great, right? But you do that sometimes by looking a little more contemporary, a little more, little less edgy, I guess is the word that I want.
So you reeled it in a little bit.
A little bit on the outside. Although, you know, I think that this car is a lot better looking from the back. Seeing those taillights lit up, they are really something. We spent some extra time with the studio on getting that in there, integrating that very nicely. You know, we've spent some time on, can't see it from this side because the doors are missing, but on the way the doors and things flow together and the way we get the blackout up there at the base of the A-pillar, a lot of great work was done there. And again, the idea is get more people to come in. You know, the talk about electrics is one thing, right? But you want them to come in, see it, and say, you know, now that's a car that I can see me driving.
Well, yeah, the whole industry's got to grow the segment. It's still right. roughly 3% of sales, and right. that's not going to cut it.
No. So need it to be bigger.
We do. And, hey, we've got a phone call coming in. Ben, let's bring that first phoner in.
Hey, John. This is Warren from Paris, California at the Studebaker Ranch. I was wondering if anybody has thought of a signal, like a green light bar, say, under the license plate, both front and rear, for vehicles that are being operated under the autonomous condition. That would be advantage for not only other drivers, but also for law enforcement. Just your thoughts on this. Thank you very much, and enjoying the show. Goodbye.
Thanks for the question. It's not exactly about the Volt, but that has been talked about, of when cars are in autonomous mode. When we get to that point, because they're not quite here yet, of having some sort of indication, just like there was talk years ago of when you trigger the ABS in the brakes, that maybe the brake lights would pulse or something to signal to the car behind that something was going on and they better
Which
be aware.
Which they do in Europe.
In
That's
Europe.
Allowed in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, but not in the U.S. Let's see, what else? Let's talk more Volt. Did you change the charger so that it can charge more quickly?
So, you know, we made the battery larger. And we made the charger a little bit larger to go with the larger battery. We still have a 4.5 hour charge time on 240 volts, which is still, you know, works for people very well. What we also found, though, is that about half of our current owners still charge with 120 volts. This is something we didn't necessarily expect a number of years ago when we were going through this, but we were seeing this trend. And so we did go ahead and we redesigned our charge cord to be more robust, and we also made it easier to get to. We've got a new storage area in the back so that you don't have to lift up and get under the floor where we used to have it. You know, what do you need in a charger? This is probably the question you're really asking me, right? How big does it need to be? And a lot of that has to do with the size of the battery and how much time. As public charging gets to be more prevalent, right, and we start to see different structures for how you might pay for public charging, whether it's by the minute or is it by the kilowatt hour or whatever, right, I think we'll see that that's going to continue to evolve and change. But today, when you're charging at home 4.5 hours, it's pretty good. And then that's where we are today.
Didn't you also find with Gen 1 that a lot of the owners were essentially topping off their electricity wherever they were, sort of opportunistically charging?
So, you know, that's an interesting thing. So I spent a lot of time talking with owners at the auto show, and a few of them came to me and said, you know, every time I went somewhere, I used to always be looking for a plug. Always, always, right? One guy said, I was like a drug addict looking for a place to plug in. And he said, you know, after about a year, I don't do that anymore because I don't have to. The great thing about the Volt is, you know, if you can't find a plug, it doesn't matter, okay? You're not going to get stuck somewhere. And I kind of view this as, you know, another great way to get more people to adopt electric transportation, okay? As we get into cars that have, you know, much more electric range, things, you know, like the Chevy Bolt concept and those kinds of things, then we'll start to have different conversations, I think, about what people do and the way they're going to act, right? And a lot of it'll really have to do with their day-to-day situation. But I think what we actually see is there's less of that going on, particularly with the Volt.
And the charger is a little more efficient too, right?
Charger's a little more efficient too, and that helps us. That helps us with our numbers.
We've got, and maybe we'll make this the last question here. Ken Gimble wrote in to say, "Be sure to thank Andrew for the improved mileage per charge." He says, "I used 132 gallons of gas in only over three years.
Uh-huh.
That's not a lot, as you know." And he says, "And thanks for those knobs. More knobs going forward." But he wants to know, one of the 2016s scheduled for production, and when will you announce pricing?
Right. So as I said earlier, pricing will be out in about 6 to 8 weeks, and we're still shooting for the third quarter of this year for availability of the car.
Cool.
Are we going to see more technology like this from General Motors going forward?
I think so. Now, of course, I can't officially comment on future product plans, but, you know, let's face it. It's about whether the public continues to accept it and you know, continues to grow in what they want and willingness. You know, we announced the Malibu Hybrid, right? We've talked about the Bolt concept and taking that to production. As you can see, we're kind of on a path to present more options out there so that...
There's the ELR for Cadillac. I think there's a plug-in coming in the CT6, I think. And let's see, there's two other brands then, Buick and GMC. I think we'll hear something about that in the future at some point. And that's not a question to you.
Thank you, John.
That's good. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for coming on and especially for bringing this cutaway of the Volt. Really cool. I can't wait to drive the thing, you know, because I liked Gen 1 and Gen 2 just sounds like it's better all the way around.
Yep. You're really going to like it.
Cool. Thanks again, and we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a minute to talk about more things going on in the automotive industry.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
So pretty cool. This Volt thing, I'm serious about that. I want to drive this.
I can't wait to see it. And it's nice that it's coming out without the political backlash that surrounded the first one, with the government motors, all that noise. You remember Rush Limbaugh was anti-Volt and whatever. We got none of that nonsense this time. It'll be a nice, clean launch.
It's surprising to me in some ways that, you know, that they decided to, you know, stay the course, continue to develop the car, and not look at it from the point of view of like, sales weren't all that good for the first generation car. Maybe we ought to try something differently. And I think that what they did was, you know, advanced it at all levels, which is a good thing to do.
I'm wondering if we're reaching a tipping point, too. You know, battery costs are coming down, still too high, but the glide path, as they say, is very favorable. And, you know, you look at the percentage improvements that they're getting, take that out 5 years or so, and...
Some disruptive stuff coming, too, I think, regarding graphene and some of the other stuff that...
You were talking about that before the show. New ways of making batteries.
Right, and I think that's got a lot of promise. I think that's what Elon Musk has got in mind when he talks about doubling range and so forth for the next generation.
And we did a show last year for the TV show with Anne-Marie Sastry from the battery company SACT3, and she's doing solid-state batteries. I don't even know what that means. But she's talking about even more significant cost reduction than what Elon's talking about.
And who knows if Quant...
And Quant with the flow cell
battery, you know? I mean, there's all these things that could happen. You never know.
That's right.
Well, you figure, I mean, you've got you know, physicists and scientists working at it in universities, you've got, you know, giant electric companies working on it. You've got chemical companies working on it.
We've had that program for eons. They've all got better tools now. The computers are better, and where the progress is speeding up. And so I think that's why we're starting to see something now.
Yeah. If they get the cost out, that could be the game changer. That will be the game changer. But right now, still pretty pricey.
Well, it's still pricey, but I mean, and then you know, they've got to face the requirements in the carb states, you know, coming up in.
Yeah, they got to have these cars no matter what. I mean,
right.
The law is the law. You know, the trick is, can you get the public to buy them and buy them in enough numbers to recoup your investment and maybe a little
especially
bit more?
With gas staying down here in these in the cheap seats.
It's going to be hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, another big news this week, Jeremy Clarkson. Boy, that was global news, fired by the BBC.
Nobody is irreplaceable. You know, I mean, everyone thought, oh, you know, it's the most, the number one show in England or Europe or I don't know, the
world,
planet Earth.
I read, I think I got this right, that there are 350 million viewers worldwide. I mean, that's extraordinary.
214 countries makes the BBC 74 million a year, more than any other BBC show. The most famous presenter, as they say, on BBC television.
So is the guy a total doofus for throwing away a gig like that? Or is he just going to walk to another network and make more money?
You know, to me, if you're that other network, you know, how do you set up a prenup or something? Because we can't have workplace violence. That is the thing. Yeah. That's what got him in this position.
It wasn't all his derogatory remarks before this.
No.
That got him in hot water, but it didn't get him fired.
No, and you really have to, no employer can condone that. And anyone else who picks him up is going to have to say, hey, don't think, you know, that this is the same thing. So I don't know.
Well, OK, so basically what he did was that apparently it was a 20-minute tirade against a senior producer, which ended up Clarkson slugging the guy. The guy had to go to the hospital.
You cannot,
as a result of that,
do that.
So the director general of the BBC said it was, and I quote, physical violence with sustained verbal abuse. And apparently this wasn't the first time.
And wasn't it about his supper or something?
Yeah.
Apparently
they were at some hotel somewhere, and you know, apparently Jeremy wanted a steak, and the chef had gone home, and he got a cold plate instead. And that is what led to
this. This wasn't a journalistic, you've compromised my journalistic ethics. No, this was just a hissy fit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to me, it sounds like... the guy's got some issues, because what a whale of a gig to have, and to throw a punch at a producer. And it's very interesting. I didn't realize that he had connected on his punch and sent this guy to the hospital, because all I had seen was there was a fracas and that he had thrown a punch.
Yeah, and I mean, I was doing some reading at other things that Jeremy Clarkson has said publicly over the years. And it's like, whoa, I mean, how he maintained that job for as long as he did is absolutely astonishing. But you know, you think about it. I mean, his persona was basically is you know, being this crabby, snarky.
Yeah, the public loves that sort of thing.
And,
they love the bad boy.
But then, so then the question is, you know, about the replaceability sort of thing. So apparently, James May and Richard Hammond, the other two guys, their contracts are coming up for renewal at the end of the month anyway.
They've said they won't go on without him. So,
you know, and I saw a clip with May, who was basically saying, well, you know, there was a special chemistry between the three of us, and I don't know that we could, you know, with someone else, recapture that.
Would this have gone on for 10 more years as it was? Maybe everyone kind of thought, a big spectacular end gets us out of the potential of having to put it down, you know, because it
went... With a bullet through the head, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, maybe.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure it's going to be debated. I'm sure this is not the end of the story by any stretch. But I just had to bring it up because it was global news.
And he's got enough money that he can retire to his island on the Isle of Man or wherever he lives, and and he can do just fine.
Okay, Gary, you got something else that I'm dying to get into. So set the stage.
All right. So because listicles are such important things on the internet nowadays, Cars.com came up with their top 10 annoying features in cars. So I thought it might be interesting if I threw out these as we're going through this and get your reaction to these things and any other reaction that you might have.
Also, we've got some viewers who are sending in their pet peeves. So, hey, get us the email. We might get to it on the show yet.
Okay, so let's go. Touch-sensitive controls.
I agree. Those have not been perfected.
I hate them.
Yeah.
I hate them. And you're talking about sliding volume bar.
You want to change the radio station. You want to change the temperature.
Nothing moves. Maybe it clicks or
maybe
buzzes, right. But yeah.
Right. So it goes way loud, and oh, now it's too soft, and it's way loud, and you can't find anything.
Well, the thing that I recently had, it was in a General Motors car, actually. And, I mean, I had a hell of a time figuring out how to change the tuner.
Yeah.
With you know, because I thought, well, maybe if I push this thing, and then it just like does nothing. I mean, it was ridiculous. I don't like those either.
So we're on board with that.
All right, this is sort of number two and number one strike me as being fairly
the same.
Low-hanging fruit, obvious.
Touch screen dependent controls.
I hate touch screens.
Now wait a minute. You've driven a Tesla.
I have driven a touchscreen.
The whole thing is touchscreen.
Yeah.
And we love that one.
No, I love it. But the problem with touchscreens is driving down a road, a bumpy road, and you're trying to hit a spot on the screen with your finger. It's not easy to do. Whereas I love what the Germans have settled on, this rotary sort of joystick kind of controller. You can rest your forearm on the console or armrest, and you're very accurate. Whereas trying to hit a touchscreen, I don't like it.
Stereo tuning buttons instead of knobs. So this would be...
Yeah. Everyone's heavily on record.
Right.
Anti-
so if you want volume up, you have to keep going ding, ding,
yeah,
ding.
Yeah, no,
ding,
give me a knob for that.
Yeah, it's that's why knobs came 100 years ago.
Right.
Because everybody went, hey, that's so intuitive and it makes sense.
Yeah, it sort of strikes me that you have a knob and it's, you know, it's a very intuitive thing and that's why people use them. And then the response seems to be, well, you know, people are used to doing things with their fingers and swiping and doing things like that instead. But then if you think about it, well, you know, why do we have steering wheels? Isn't that an old technology? Shouldn't we do something else?
No.
Well, I know no, but I mean, it's just like the same
argument. Bring back the tiller.
Yeah, that could be it. Navigation systems that lock out passengers. You're driving the car. You want to set
Don't lock anybody out.
Yeah. Not even the driver.
Don't lock me out either.
Some will do is allow you to voice enter as a driver while you're underway. I like that. But we'll get back into voice recognition,
if that works,
in a minute, too, because we're going to take...
I don't like to talk to my devices.
Okay. Well, hold that thought. We'll come back to it. We're going to take another quick break here.
There's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine This Week. Every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine This Week. You can't get more inside the industry.
So, okay, Gary, back right. to the top 10 things we hate in cars.
Okay, this one I'm a little surprised by. Giant key fob.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The big lump in your pocket. And you know what I always do, too, is I take that big lump out of my pocket and I put it in the console or the door pocket, and I forget them there all the time. I can't believe how many times.
Free Bentley.
I've got, yeah, a big expensive car in the parking lot that I'm test driving. The keys are in there that anybody could walk away with.
I'm making a mental note.
Yeah.
Be by John when he's driving a car with a giant key fob. Square cup holders.
That doesn't bother me. I don't even...
Incorrect. Most cups are not square.
Unless you're drinking Fiji, right?
But it'll accommodate a round cup anyway.
Yeah, true.
No, I've not seen that as being a problem. Auto stop start.
Some people hate it.
Only if it's poorly executed, yeah. Like the early BMWs where the whole car kind of...
With the manual transmission.
Oh, those are terrible. Yeah. But modern ones I'm driving now, that doesn't bother me.
Although I've talked to chauffeurs... in Europe, who do a lot of stop-and-go driving, they hate it. They
Why?
Just hate it. You know, that's a good question. They couldn't really explain it, but it was like they just were like, because the engine goes off, and then it has to start.
Yeah, I'm used to it.
I always leave it engaged.
I remember being in Japan in the early 1980s and taking taxis, and the taxi cab drivers who were, you know, like religious about saving fuel would turn the engine off physically with the key at every traffic light and then start it back up again.
Yeah, without the fancy batteries.
Yeah, none of that.
Of course, that's why in Europe they did the same thing. Why you get a yellow light right before the green. And when it's red, you get that yellow. That's the turn the car back on thing. Yeah.
I didn't realize
that. That I didn't know.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, and we're going to have more of them, right? I mean...
Make peace with all the start-stop. Yeah.
What do you get? 5% or 8% on the EPA cycle? They'll give you that bump?
There's like a
if you have
credit,
Right. So, I mean, that's why Gary's right. That's why everyone's going to get it. Because you put a switch there and you get another 5 or 8%,
right.
Whatever it is.
Okay, here's Frank's favorite, voice-controlled systems.
I'm glad that they have them, but I just, as a rule, Siri does not know me at all. I don't ever talk to Siri. I don't like to talk to the cars, by and large.
I find that when you have good voice recognition, entering an address, just saying, you know, I want to go to 24021 Research Drive in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Pow!
It is, I hear this is
so much easier than those rotary dials like Acura uses, or you know the touchpad that other you know. So for me, that's where voice recognition really works.
See, I'm sort of with Frank, and I found that when I've had cars that have had Google as their navigation system, that it's predictive the same way as when you're putting in a search on Google for, you know, whatever. And so as you start putting in that address, it gives you some choices. And so you get there very quickly without having to talk to your car. And I think as we have more of that, that'll be better.
Well, I'll say this. My phone works far better than any nav system I've ever used in any car.
As far as the voice?
Well, not just the voice, everything. I mean, I can just tell it, you know. And I want a stand on the dash and just put my phone there, and I'm good with that.
So you wouldn't want it mirrored on your screen somehow?
I don't even think I'd.
You got to buy a cheap car to get that.
Yeah. Yeah, a Spark.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, number 9, car alarms.
Is that a thing anymore?
You know, on older cars, that you know, and rarely now I do hear them going off in parking lots, but not like I did a few years ago.
I only hear
them
going off when I've bent down and somehow pressed the button on the key fob in my pocket. Then I'm fishing it out and trying to turn it off.
What's next?
Small side mirrors.
Yeah. I can't say I've ever gotten a car and went...
Mirrors. Most of the time when people complain about mirrors, I want to check and see how they've adjusted them, because they're probably not adjusted
they're
right.
They're not adjusted right.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
So what's your take on the mirrors that now have that other spherical center to them, so you're supposed to be able to see blind spot?
Again, if it was set right in the first place, you don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you're in a delivery van or something, you know, in the city with our, you know, where you've got to maneuver. And
that'll show me two lanes over the way my mirror is adjusted, so I don't need that.
Mm-hmm. And do we think that side mirrors are going to exist, or will they be replaced by little cameras?
Well, there is an aerodynamic cost to them, which largely goes away with a little tiny, now incredibly cheap camera there. The question is, do you put the screen right inside so people are still looking in the same place for it? In which case, that screen, that's plus cost more than the mirror. So I don't know, because I don't think I want to learn to look at the center screen for my side view mirrors and whatnot.
Well, you know, people have talked about using cameras for decades. Every concept car these days seems to have one. There's cameras everywhere for that 360-degree view, right, the bird's eye when you back up, and it's going to happen at some point. At some point.
Well, the VW XL1
uses cameras
because there's no.
Yeah.
Backlight to see out of, and there's...
Did you get a load of that? There was a Rogue they were driving around that had a camera rearview inside mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that gave you the exact
Cadillac
same...
Cadillac has shown a rearview mirror that's got a camera.
The funny thing is, I think it is not a mirror image. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's a view out the back, and so things are not backwards like you're expecting. You know, ambulance will be written, you know, the right way or whatever on that. So that's kind of weird.
Hey, we've got some viewer pet peeves here, and I like this one. Armand wrote in to say, sun visors that don't reach to the B pillar when you pull them to the side.
Yeah.
Amen, brother. In fact, remember, Ford was really good at this when they were really paying attention to being best in class. They had two sun visors. So you could flip one to the side and flip one down over the windshield. So as you're making all these turns, you're not constantly flipping the visor back and forth. I thought that was great. But apparently the bean counters got a hold of that, and they cut the 12 cents that it added to the cost of the car.
So what do you like more, the sun visors that have the nylon bushing, which allow you to pull
slide,
it?
Slide, yes, please.
Or the little insert plastic?
No, the slide is the professional way to do it.
Buzzard says he hates auto-locking doors. He says, I fucking hate them. Don't see the point of them.
He was talking about fracking.
They can almost always turn them off.
More,
that's usually a preference thing, so I don't begrudge offering the feature and maybe making someone find how to turn it off. But it's almost always
reprogrammable through your big fat fob, generally.
Right.
Or the screen or something. Right. You just
hook a keyboard up to that big fat fob and you're just...
Marion Kershavalan says the most annoying feature for him is having to go buy fuel.
Well, we heard that guy who had the vault for 10 years and put, what, 134 gallons?
Yeah, something like that.
Here's another. I kind of agree with this one. Steve wrote in to say he doesn't like the openings in the bottom of the steering wheel that are too small for my big hands, so I keep hitting the Bluetooth button on his Honda Accord Sport. I agree with that. I don't have big hands, and the way steering wheels are designed, sometimes when you're driving down the freeway, it's just fun to slip your hand into a different position on the wheel, you know, so that you get a break from constantly being, at least for me, it's, you know, 9 and 3, or not 9 and 3, but
yeah,
10 and 3. 10 and 2.
9 and 3 is the way to go.
It's supposed to be airbag.
I just got back from BMW teen driving school where they were teaching my 16-year-old nephew 9 and 3. Use your thumbs to push against those little widgets, not rest
the,
on top
the little footballs, as they call them on the wheel. Let's see, and I think that's Robert wrote in to say he hates infotainment systems using voice recognition that don't work or require specific commands. And I agree with that. I hate the specific.
They're all getting conversational now. That's the new way to do voice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Except in my experience, voice recognition is worse than it was just a few years ago. I don't know what it is, but in my experience,
I think a few years ago when you did have to learn those commands, it was all on board, and now it's cloud, so there's a little delay based into that, and I don't know. Are you taking nominations from us now?
Yeah. So what have we not heard?
One recently, you know, the keyless entry and starting is wonderful. And some companies, like Mercedes, decouple those. They charge extra for keyless entry and extra for keyless starting. So now I have a thing where, okay, I have keyless entry, or I don't have keyless entry. I have to whip the fob out and unlock the door. And then when I get in, there's nowhere to put it. So I have to put it back in my pocket and push the button. Now when I get out, I got to fish it back out again to lock the car. Stupid.
Wow.
Yeah, really stupid.
Wow. Dad, talk about nickel and dime.
Yeah. Oof. Throw that in for free. Yeah. And in the same vein, BMW will charge you some amount of money, I don't remember the number, for Bluetooth phone. And then it's an extra $120 for Bluetooth audio. Now, we all know there is no more hardware there. That is just a money grab. And cut it out now.
Yes. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Gary, what do you not like, or have we covered it all?
Well, speaking of this need to put the key or not key, the V, what do you think about the VW thing where you stick in
the key fob? The key,
yeah, and you stick the key fob in there.
You know, and Volvos have that too.
Actually, all the keyless entry systems had that to begin with. You had to push the key fob in. And then I guess they needed the real estate on the dashboard or something, but now it's very rare to see.
Yeah, so the curious thing about with key fobs is that whatever happens to locking glove boxes, is that going to go away entirely?
I got to tell you, I can't tell you the last time I looked to see whether a glove box locked or not. It's been years.
Do you ever look? I look.
Yeah, I don't. You know, I live out of a briefcase that sits on the seat. I never have anything in the glove compartment, so I never care. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The only reason I ever open up the glove box is to see if there's an owner's manual in there.
And if I get to that point, there's a serious misdesign.
Yes.
If I need to crack the manual, someone screwed up.
Well, you know, I'm test driving this i8 right now, and I thought, well, I want to pop the hood and see what it's like. And, you know, I think I'm pretty good at finding where they hide all these things. And, man, I was on my hands and knees, inside, outside, upside down, this, back and forth. So finally, I popped open the glove box to get the manual. There's no manual in there. So I did get out my phone and asked Google, how do you pop the hood on an i8? And I found out it takes two people, and one of them has to be a BMW technician. They don't want you popping the hood on this thing. And you need special tools to get into it.
Yeah, and when you get that off, it's funny. There's some sort of acoustic cover on it, and the vents in it look like a sad face. There's like a couple of, and then a little.
That's why they don't want you in there.
It's really funny.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that you ended up having to find a touch sensitive screen that would allow you to put in a series of commands and then open the hood.
Well, maybe that's what it is. But, you know, like I said, I never found.
I think we did a separate at birth with the sad Mac face and that little engine cover on the i8.
Wow.
Hey, Carmen tells me we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan out in Old Pan.
All right,
I was just
Jonathan.
Wondering what you guys thought of Cadillac's new 3-liter V6 twin turbo making 400 horsepower. And do you think that'll put the 3.6-liter twin turbo of the ATS-V out of production in the future, or are they going to both run concurrently? Thank you very much, Frank. It's great to see you. It's a great show, and the Volt is awesome. Thank you.
Cool. Good.
Yeah, I'm enthusiastic about it. And at least for the near term, they are running concurrently. The 3.6 twin turbo is definitely a performance engine, and the 3-liter is a mainstream range-topping engine. I think inevitably at some point, the new architecture will underpin a 3.6-liter twin turbo, and that'll make even more power because it's got all these other new efficiencies. But that architecture is very interesting, and it's first to market with direct injection, twin turbo, six cylinder, and auto start stop. I think that combination nobody else is doing. So
yeah, I was impressed. What was it, 137 horses?
132 or something like that.
Per
liter? Yeah.
I remember when, if you wanted 100 horsepower per liter, you were talking about some exotic Lotus thing that.
Sure.
And now it's like, man.
It's also interesting. So we were all at a program last week where we saw that engine. That was last week, wasn't
it?
And I thought it was very interesting that Cadillac, named names in terms of, this is who we're competing against.
Yep.
And they didn't obscure it. I mean, by and large, they just came right out and said,
we're better than Audi, we're better than Mercedes, we're better than BMW, right.
And in terms of quietness, better than Infiniti.
Which I was surprised that they picked that one, because I have thought that's kind of a thrashy motor myself, but.
Well,
a 3.7 is not, to me, the...
I don't know. I would hope that they were picking best-in-class targets to say, look, we beat this. And to your point, though, Gary, Cadillac's got to take the gloves off. They got to go and really all elbows go into the market because they're turning out terrific product. In my opinion, ATS, wow, A-plus all the way around. It ain't selling. CTS, awesome car. Not doing too good. So here comes the CT6. It's probably going to be brilliant, better than those two. Boy, they got to figure out how to crack the code of getting people in the showrooms and buying these things because product alone is not doing it. The product's there. So so that's why I think they're not afraid. Hey, may as well take the gloves off.
Right.
Nothing else is working from a sales standpoint.
But do you think that will attract, somebody who's going to buy an Audi would say, but this engine, it's got better specs. Do you think that would change minds, or would people still say, that's a Cadillac, that's an Audi?
How long did it take for Audi to get over sudden acceleration?
20 years.
And Cadillac's digging out of a full Cleveland white patent leather shoe, whatever, they're 10 years into it, but...
You got 10 more?
Maybe. Everything's faster nowadays, so,
Yeah, I think it's more than 10 years. But, I'm not sure what it takes, but I don't have the solution. I think it's, as Audi did, just keep your nose to the grindstone. Keep plugging
away.
Keep
your foot on the gas. Second guess and hit the brake and do something else like Lincoln has been doing. Their 10-year clock hadn't totally started yet, I don't think. So, Or maybe it's 1 or 2 years in, but...
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens with Lincoln. I've said all along, they've got 4 all-new products coming. I think we're 4... in right now, MKZ, MKX, MKC.
And New York, we'll see this new one.
The S, right? It's got to be the S.
Is overripe for replacement, right. That's for sure.
But, everything is still much better modified Fords, but it's still modified Fords, whereas, Cadillac has got its own platforms, at least for the time being, its own powertrains. And I cut Lincoln or Ford Motor Company some slack. Let's see what they can do with these new 4 cars. And if it's like, we're getting some traction, we're making some, okay, now let's belly up with some mega investment.
In China.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah. A lot of traction over there.
Well, be careful. They're talking about how, 3 of their top 10 dealers in the world are now in China. The sales in China are still minuscule. They won't tell you what the sales are.
It's a percentage.
And there's
basis.
A reason
that they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're saying that. And you know, and then True Car came out with those numbers a few weeks ago about the return on cars being sold here versus being sold in China.
Oh, yeah.
So you know, they're buying a hell of a lot more cars, but in terms of making profit on those cars, not so good for the car makers.
Yeah, China sells like 3 million more vehicles a year, but in the U.S., automakers rake in like $150 billion more. So, yeah, revenue and profits are, this is still...
Well, you look at the rich mix, too. I mean, there's a little difference there.
Yeah, sure. In China, there's a lot of cars that go out the door at $8,000, you know, rinky-dinky little cheapo models.
Yeah.
And you don't get that here.
Yeah, so the this is the True Car numbers. Chinese brands had an average MSRP of $15,706. Well, these are Chinese brands domestic. Foreign makes average $32,278.
Well, look, at some point, China will surpass the U.S.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. I mean, you know, the sheer number of vehicles is going to continue to increase, and as Chinese standard of living goes up, they're just going to spend more on cars.
They'll buy more Lincolns.
Right.
Well, they love the name, and they remember, you know, the presidential visits in Lincolns and so forth back way back when, kind of like they like Buicks, you know.
Presidential visits
and
of Lincoln.
And they don't have Lincoln. Any fond memories like that of a Lexus, you know, because a lot of Chinese still kind of are testy about Japanese, period.
Very much.
So those guys have a bigger hole to climb out of with no matter how good their product is. And, you know, Lincoln and Buick roll in there with a lot of goodwill, no matter how good their stuff is. So.
Yeah, until, you know, the geopolitical thing gets China against the United States or vice versa, and, you know, then we suffer the backlash that the Japanese are facing.
Does Cadillac resonate in China?
Yeah, I'm not sure to the same extent that Buick does. But
yeah, Buick is way more successful in China than Cadillac is, and Cadillac's nowhere near what the German luxury brands are. The real interesting one will be to see what Lincoln does, and I say that because Ford was really late to the party in China. I thought too late, and now I'm just blown away at the rocket growth that they've had. They've surpassed all the Japanese brands, including Toyota. They're probably, with this new plant that they just opened in the last week, going to surpass Hyundai. You know, Hyundai's really powerful in China. And so when I look at what's like, wow, Ford got there so late, and, you know, they're just banging on the door of the top leaders now. Why can't they do that with Lincoln?
Yeah.
Why not? So that'll be the one to watch.
And they're calling, instead of black label, it's presidential.
Is that right?
Over there, yeah.
Well, they told me, yeah, that Chinese view the Lincoln brand as presidential. And they're not thinking Abe Lincoln. They're thinking of, you know, all the U.S. presidents that they've seen pictures of driving in Lincolns.
Getting shot in Lincolns and so forth.
That's right. Well, they got shot in Cadillacs, too. But I guess that hasn't helped sales of Cadillac. So I think we're at the top of the hour here, aren't we? We are. So, Frank, great having you here.
Always a big good time.
Cool. And then, Gary, you and I will be at the New York Auto Show next week, and we'll be shooting this show at that show. So,
stuff there this year.
I know, the New York show.
Yeah, more than L.A., it seemed like, last year, maybe.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It's like New York is a lot of good stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, great seeing the both of you guys. And great seeing all of you who have tuned in. Signing off for now.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.